I'm very happy now to welcome back to the program Dennis Gromelski. He's co-founder and executive director of the Fusion Theater Company. And Akushla Bastabal joins us. She is an actor in the Fusion Theater Company's new production of Humble Boy, which is a play by Charlotte Jones. It's being performed at the Lensic here in Santa Fe tomorrow and Wednesday, Tuesday and Wednesday, the 7th and 8th of May at 8 in the evening. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
Great to be here.
Great to have you. Now, I was thinking as I was reading this play, and I haven't seen it yet. I guess you've performed it in Albuquerque already?
Yeah, we just completed up our two-weekend run at the Cell Theater, and then we're returning after the Lensic down to the Kima.
So we talked to you about your production of Clybourne Park not too long ago, and now I'm reading this play, so I have the privilege of reading them but not seeing them before we speak. And a lot of what goes into doing really great theater is choosing a really great play. Both of these were just beautifully written, amazing plays. How do you go about choosing them?
Well, actually, this play was chosen. We were looking for a piece to do in collaboration with the Isaiah Conference, which had happened last autumn, about a 4 or 5 month period in Albuquerque, Santa Fe, and also up to Taos.
And the Isaiah Conference being all about art, science, and technology.
Yes, exactly. And it's a very prestigious conference. It's the first time it was in the United States this year. It was the first time in 8 years it had been here. And we were looking for a play that dealt with science to perform in conjunction with the festival. Unfortunately, the timing, we've been pretty good the last couple years about specializing in works directly off the Broadway and first-run productions of Broadway and world stage pieces, and we were able to get the rights to a couple other pieces that we thought would make sense at the beginning of the season. Those we also performed in Santa Fe, Other Desert Cities, and Freud's Last Session. But we did not want to shelve this play. You know, we didn't want to say we're not going to do it, because quite honestly, at very first read, everyone in our company, the production staff that read the play, thought that it was probably the strongest written play of the season. And it really resonated on many levels with us.
It's very British. I mean, you read this play and you can hear it being spoken, and you can feel and see the gestures of it just in the script. So, of course, wherever your actors come from, they're doing the British accents full on.
Yes, they are. And it is set in contemporary times in a garden in England, in the UK. And it is set actually in a beekeeper's garden. And the lead character is actually an astrophysicist as well. So that's where the science part came in to this piece.
And his father is also a scientist, being a beekeeper, being an entomologist. And the father has just passed away, and so we are in the garden right after the death of a person who, in a way, is a central character, although we don't really quite exactly see him. Mm-hmm. Now, this is another thing about this play, is that it has a surprise ending, but we can't talk about it because we'll be giving the whole thing away.
There are connections, reverberations with the Hamlet story. I mean, it's not in any way, you know, a literary translation of the Hamlet story, but there's an echo of the Hamlet story. So,
interesting.
In terms of mystery and mysterious characters, there, I think there's some echo there.
And
that doesn't say too much.
No, I guess not. I mean, it's the kind of thing, like, there are certain movies where at the end you figure out what the secret is, and then you just want to watch the whole thing all over again. Mm-hmm. And this is kind of one of those.
Crying Game comes to mind.
For example, yeah. So there is the whole science element in it, both the astrophysics and the insects, both of which serve kind of as operative metaphors in the play. Could you talk about that a little bit and how you interpret that as actors, as producers of this play?
Well, on two levels there. So in terms of the insects, if you're talking about the bees, there is a lot of reference to bees in it. And because Felix, who's the main protagonist, his father, James Humble, was a beekeeper and a biologist. And he, you know, in a bee colony, the queen bee is the matriarch. And you see that echoed So it's used as a metaphor for the piece because it's echoed in the household, in the humble household, where Flora Humble...
Who's not very humble.
Well, she's a great character, and she's beautifully played by Dennis's partner, Jackie. It's just beautiful. But, you know, she is very much the matriarch and has all of her sort of her drones around her. And so it's very clever. Her use of language and metaphor is very clever. And then with the astrophysics, Felix is constantly looking at the stars, and he's sort of trying to find meaning from superstring. He's trying to come up with M theory, which is sort of the mother of all theories. So mother being, again, the reference to mother is very interesting, because as a mother, Flora, you know, is compromised in some way. You know, he doesn't consider her to be a great mother. So there's this constant sort of referencing back and forth, both to the human dimension and then to this sort of this much greater dimension. But he's an astrophysicist, and he's trying very hard to find this this mother of all theories, superstring theory, which connects quantum mechanics and relativity, and he just can't do it. But what's so interesting is he's so stuck on in the stars and in big theory that he can't really connect with what's happening in his own life in a very simple way.
You know,
he's socially inept.
Right.
Which, you know, is not...
A socially inept scientist?
Yeah, well... But like, in a way, we talk. There are sort of connections to Hamlet as well, and he is like Hamlet, you know, trying to sort of seek some. He's trying to understand, trying to come to terms with. Very different to Hamlet in terms of Hamlet's main thing is whether I should live or not live. That's not so much Felix's main question, but it is very much a seeking of clarity. And of course, he's so stuck. His head is so stuck up there that it takes him a long time to kind of understand what's right in front of his nose.
And when the play opens, they've just come from his father's funeral, where he's run out having basically shirked his duty of giving a eulogy, and somebody else who was just a kind of acquaintance entomologist gave the eulogy. And it's a very funny play in many ways. I mean, he basically compared the deceased life cycle to that of aphids.
Right,
and it sort of goes on from there. But you start out seeing this character as a wimpy guy who's in the shadow of his mother, and then his character develops over the course of the play.
Absolutely.
Where you see kind of what he's gotten out from under, which is a complex and messed up family situation.
It's a very interesting piece in that, in reference to the original production, which did win a couple of Oliviers and a couple other Critics Awards as well, in London, it's referred to as a comedy, and it's not a Seinfeld type comedy at all. It's a very funny play with very funny moments, but it's a lot deeper than that. There's a lot going on in this piece. It references classical literature. It is appealing to. I've had great compliments from, you know, being in New Mexico, from astrophysicists that have come and seen the show. Great compliments relating to them, but also to the common man, and those concepts are really worked out well. And believe it or not, you know, we have a very strong neighborhood beekeeping community in the state of New Mexico.
That's
and
right.
There are over 650, I think, beekeepers in the state's association. So there is there's a lot for a lot of people to want to come and see this show.
Right. So come one, come all, entomologists, beekeepers, astrophysicists,
mothers, sons.
Theater people, mothers, sons, daughters,
fathers.
that pretty much. I think that's just about everybody. We got it all. Well, you play a Kush Labastable, a character named Rosie, who is the daughter of the man that Felix's mother has been perhaps carrying on with, and that Felix himself, it turns out, had been also carrying on with. And,
mm-hmm.
and she is one funny, tough cookie.
She is. She's great. She's it's a real pleasure for an actor to play something that's just so well scripted. And
it's
just
typecasting,
so,
isn't it?
Oh,
is
absolutely. It? Thanks, Dennis.
I'm kidding.
But yeah, you know, it's really fun because she's a very full character. There's just, and she's, her father is kind of foul-mouthed, I'd say, but she's just got the blunt edge of that. So she's very straightforward, very no-nonsense, and in a way she's a counterfoil to Felix, who is so caught up in abstractions, and she's very much about what happens in the everyday life, and you'll see in the play. I don't want to say too much about it, but they have an affair early on, and in a way she's sort of like, if you're thinking of the Hamlet story again, she's like the Ophelia character, but she's not like Ophelia.
Ladies and gentlemen, to figure out what that means, come to the Lensic tomorrow or Wednesday night at 8 o'clock to see this play called Humble Boy. Now, it's written by Charlotte Jones. Tell us about her. Who is she?
Charlotte Jones came onto the scene pretty heavily back in, I believe it was in 2000 in London, when she had three plays produced and was named the new emerging playwright in London at the time. And she has since written quite a bit for television and film. And one of the unique elements of this piece that we were really attracted to was that it is not has not historically received the due that we feel it should have.
This play?
Yeah, it had opened in One Olivier in it opened in August of 2001 in in London, and then kind of fell. It did come, and it enjoyed a long run at the Manhattan Theatre Club in New York. But that happens, I think, a little later on in
2003.
Yeah, in early 2003, and kind of fell into, to use the Esther, this is kind of that
black hole
that was going on in New York at the time, and it's a terrific opportunity as well for our design team to attack this thing, because it is indeed, it takes place in an English garden, and our folks have been charged with keeping a lot of live greenery alive inside of a darkened theater. So it's been...
So you're using real plants and rose bushes and all that kind of stuff?
Absolutely, yeah.
And that's a serious challenge for your props people.
Yeah, it is. Luckily, New Mexico is a state where there's a lot of hydroponic growing and equipment to deal with inside growing. So we've been... it's not just the stage lights we have on stage.
Right, right. Very interesting. Well, I'm glad to hear that scientists have approved of the physics part of it, because there are perfectly serviceable works of art that get science wrong and it just ruins everything.
Yeah, no, she's pretty serious about her science. It's not a sort of... it's not tokenistic at all. I mean, I love the way she describes, in some character, I think it's probably Felix, describes his mother as a black hole, in that she just sucks everything into her. And it's so she's sort of, she translates these concepts that could be quite difficult for us to understand in a very human way, so we can understand them and relate to them. And yet she doesn't in any way dumb it down. So you get little sections where you learn something too. You learn something, but it's in a very, dramatically contextualized. So she's pretty sensitive about that.
It's accessible at every level, and it is absolutely pertinent to the overall storytelling.
Yeah.
That's really, the text is truly what drew us to this piece.
Well, and I think that when you're using astronomy and astrophysics as metaphors, you always hit up against the place where they fail as metaphors, because right, there are things that are fundamentally not human, not biological, and that line between the way you can and cannot use those phenomena as metaphors for human life, I think, is very interesting.
I think it's very interesting as well that Felix is full on addressing that and not succeeding. The M theory is the holy grail, basically, and you're going to butt your head in frustration no matter who you are in pursuit of that. What this play does have a lot of, and is described in the play often, is eureka moments. Moments where truly enlightenment happens. It is allowed to be.
In terms of self-discovery and everything else.
Right. Whether that be some kind of unified theory, or whether it be a child learning to catch a ball.
Right.
Yeah.
As is discussed in the play. We're talking to Dennis Grumelski and Akushla Bastabal of the Fusion Theater Company about the production of Humble Boy. Now, you are based, Dennis, the Fusion Theater Company, in Albuquerque, but really consider yourselves a sort of national professional theater company. You, Akushla, are from, well, you're from Ireland, but you're living here,
here.
For a long time, based here in Santa Fe. How'd you get involved with Fusion?
Well, actually, my husband, partner, Charles, worked with these guys last year on a beautiful production of a piece called Red, which I'm sure many people, it came to Santa Fe, so people may have seen that. Was that 2 years ago?
Yeah, 2 years ago. By John, great piece by John Logan.
But we've sort of known each other for a long while, and we're big fans of Fusion Theatre. Love the work they do, and
very, very good work.
It's really, really good work, and I have to just sort of do a little shout out to Dennis here, because he does incredible work, and it's just sort of he has a great ease about him, but this man puts in a lot of hours. And, you know, making great theatre on a professional level like this and really taking care of everybody that you work with takes not just sort of time commitment, it takes heart and soul commitment. So I feel very grateful and honoured to work with these guys. It's lovely. It's been great.
We're thrilled to have Akushla on stage. She's one of two new actors that folks will be seeing. Actually, Kelly Hazen, another performer, it's her first time with Fusion, but she had performed back in the late 90s, early 2000s with Shakespeare in Santa Fe and Southwest Repertory Theater Company in Albuquerque, so she's back as well.
At playing Mercy, who is another lovely character who we won't even go into right now. People have to just go see it.
Yeah, and actually, Diana Rigg, the actress, did win an Olivier for that role.
For playing that role in this play.
Yeah. There's also Bruce Holmes, who folks remember from Clybourne, might remember from Clybourne Park, as well as Jack and Lynn Reed, as well a star in the play, as well as Gregory Wagrowski, who played Freud in our earlier production this season. We're thrilled to be able to bring this piece to Santa Fe, and we're thrilled with our collaboration with the Lensic here. It is such an amazing, you know, I mentioned this in the curtain speech, folks in Santa Fe. I hope they can appreciate what having a world-class facility and programming really can mean to a community, because it doesn't happen elsewhere in the state.
If I haven't said it about 473 times before, shout out to Bob Martin and the Lensic.
Yeah, we love them.
They do a great, great job.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think at this time I can, you know, we've been tremendously, tremendously blessed by the reception that we've received in Santa Fe, and are really feeling like members of this community, and I think we can mention as well now that we have indeed secured dates for the 13-14 season. Our entire season, although we haven't announced it yet, will indeed be performed at the Lensic.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
Very important. I mean, people in Santa Fe, I mean, I feature a lot of theater on this program, and I really, it's very important, I think, to feature local theater. That said, having world-class theater to draw on, to be inspired by, that's a very important thing for a community.
And we really feel, you know, that we are. We aim to be not only, you know, Albuquerque and Santa Fe's professional theater company, but the state's as well. And we welcome and encompass, you know, there's such a wealth of theatrical talent in this town and in Albuquerque that we look forward to future collaboration as well.
And you've been very much honored and respected for the work you've done so far, not just in New Mexico, but nationally.
Yeah, we were very fortunate last year to have been named by the American Theater Wing, the organization that founded and produces the Tony Awards. We were named as one of the 10 emerging theater companies in the United States. And besides with a wonderful check to our nonprofit organization, that also brought some legitimacy to New Mexico, not just the work that we're doing, but I think with what's going on in New Mexico in general. And we've really tried to make that a stepping stone and have people claim that honor and award as their own and not just ours. It's a labor of love. You know, we put lots of hours into this. We care deeply about what we do. And as I'm always saying from the stage, there is no there is no fourth wall with our shows. You know, we're an ensemble company, and part of that ensemble is our patrons. I mean, it's impossible not to be when you're in our home theater if the Cell Theater seats only 70 people. And it is the same set, the same background, the same lighting that happens at the Lensic or at the Chemo or at other venues.
Where you've got 800 people, at least in the Lensic.
Right. And so people ask at the see shows at the Lensic, where, you know, where do you sit? And well, we point to the stage, and it's like, well, their feet are literally on the set. It's it's great intimacy, and I think that's drawn us a lot of close followers over the last dozen years, but now we're finding that it's translating quite well to the larger venues.
Dennis Gromelski is co-founder and executive director of the Fusion Theater Company. Akushla Bastable is actor in the play Humble Boy by Charlotte Jones. Performances are Tuesday and Wednesday, May 7th and 8th. That's tomorrow and Wednesday at 8 o'clock at the Lensic. And I want to thank you both so much for being here and look forward to our continued relationship here on the Radio Cafe.
Thanks so much. And I just wanted to, we just both wanted to give a shout out to Laurie Thomas, who's our fearless director on this production. And she's also one of the co-founders of...
Laurie is a co-founder of the theater company and often picks the most challenging work to delve into, and boy, we salute her for that. Yeah, it's always a wonderful process when Laurie's at the helm.
Excellent. Yeah, she was wonderful and just very very clear and rigorous and just brought a lot of depth to the process. So yeah, and the whole production team was just extraordinary. So.
Yeah, can't wait to see it. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thanks
you.
For
sure.
I'd like now to introduce Patrick Cook Deegan. He's West Coast Director at Inward Bound Mindfulness Education, and we're joined by John Brayman, who is an educator, and he's head of Brayman Group International, which is an educational organization. Welcome, gentlemen, to the Radio Cafe.
Hi, Mary Charlotte.
Hey, thank you for having me on.
It's great to have you. Now, let's talk about Inward Bound Mindfulness Education. It's not just a meditation program, but it's a program for teenagers that includes meditation.
Yeah, so our main focus is running mindfulness retreats for teenagers age 15 to 19. And on the retreats, we have a few different focuses. One is introducing the practice of meditation in a secular manner to teenagers. The other is introducing a way of being with the natural world and an appreciation of the natural world. And when your mind starts to quiet down through the practice of meditation, your awareness starts to open up into the wilderness and the world around you. And the third prong of what we do is we call it authentic communication. And it's just a space for teenagers to share who they are. And for many teenagers at schools or at home, they feel scared of sharing what's really going on in their lives. So it's a chance for them to really open up with the peers around them and the staff on the retreats.
I mean, you've told some amazing stories about kids who... There was one immigrant kid who had been in the United States for 10 years... And during this mindfulness retreat, he was able to open up more in 3 days than he had in 10 years.
Yeah, it was a young man from Mali. And it was on the first retreat I went on, which was about 2 years ago in Virginia. And it was just one of our weekend retreats where you come on a Friday and leave on a Sunday evening. And he'd been living with a foster family for 10 years and attending public school, but always felt left out. And on this retreat, we have small groups. So you share twice a day for an hour. And in the small groups, he said people listened to him for the first time since he'd been in the country. And he felt a feeling of acceptance that he'd never had before. And on the closing circle, he left saying that he'd made better friends in 48 hours than he had living in the United States for almost a decade.
Which is really kind of a statement about the society we're living in.
Yeah, if you look around, most people, and especially teenagers, are living in fear. You know, the fear of being judged. The fear of not achieving enough, the fear of not being enough. And so there's so little acceptance and there's so little rites of passage where we teach young people about accepting who they are and how to grow into who they're becoming, that this really gives them a space to look inward as opposed to thinking of all the things that they have to do out in the world and in terms of achieving and doing and doing.
There must be a tremendous hunger for this work once teenagers find out about it.
Yeah, it's one of those things that once people are in the door, they love it. But it's a unique thing in our culture to be offered the chance to go inward. And so some people are skeptical. They're like, what is meditation? What is inward bound? What is this? But once people are there, they understand that this is like a natural human calling to understand who we are and where we're going and where we come from. But we take so little space in our culture to actually look at that, that once people come in, they're there. And about 50% to 3/4 of the students that come on our retreats actually return each year.
Very interesting. How long has it been going on?
So we've been running retreats since 2007, and we started in Virginia and in the D.C. area. And last year, we moved out to the expanded to the West Coast. And so now we're running retreats up and down the West Coast in California, Washington State. And this year will be our first youth mindfulness retreat in New Mexico.
Ah, so that's coming up when? This June?
This June. It's June 16th to 21st at Vallecitos Mountain Ranch, which is outside of Taos. And it's at a beautiful retreat center that's set in the wilderness. It's inside a national forest.
Yeah.
And it's actually one of the first places that I did a mindfulness retreat in the United States.
Now, how did you find out about this in the first place? How did you get involved?
About Inward Bound?
Yeah.
One of my best friends was running the organization in 2011, and he got a rare heart disease and almost passed away.
And he was like 30 or something.
Yeah, 31, 32. And he was my best friend in D.C., and I'd always been interested in, I've been interested in meditation for 5 or 6 years. And this is really the only organization that was teaching youth meditation through a retreat format. And so when he took over, my other best friend named Jessica Morey, who's the current executive director of Inward Bound, we both started taking on some of the tasks since he was sick. And 3 or 4 months later, we both quit our policy jobs in Washington, D.C., and she took over as the executive director, and I moved out to the West Coast to take up the helms in the West Coast.
It's interesting. I mean, Inward Bound is a counterpart just in language to Outward Bound, which is a well-known program getting kids out into wilderness. But it seems like when you go inward, you also, as you were saying before, naturally turn your attention toward nature.
Yeah, I mean, the two most profound experiences I've ever had were, one, my first 10-day meditation retreat, and two, the first backpacking retreat that I went on in the wilderness. And I think that the power of combining them, which is what we're doing this summer in New Mexico, is maybe the most profound human experience that you can have in many ways. Because as your mind starts to quiet, then you start to notice so many things that you miss all the time. So you can go and be in the wilderness for a month, but be thinking about things you have to do at home, how you don't get along with your mom, like if you're going to remodel your kitchen. You can spend your time thinking of anything without being present. And then the moment that you start to quiet your mind, then you start to hear the birds, you start to notice the trees, you start to listen to the rivers. And then through that, your awareness just starts expanding.
It's interesting, too, because it also makes you a kinder person, whether you like it or not.
Yeah, because once you start to look inward, you start to realize what makes you happy. And ultimately, what makes humans happy is being kind to other humans.
Yeah.
And so through the process of going inwards, you actually become a more compassionate and action-oriented person outwardly. But we spend so much time focusing outwardly that on achievement and on doing things that aren't necessarily compassionate, that by spending the time to go in, I think it's actually maybe the most effective tool you could build to create a more compassionate society.
We're talking to Patrick Cook Deegan about Inward Bound mindfulness education. I also can't help but think when you're talking that when we talk about the environmental movement and climate change and the whole host of global problems from pollution to pesticides and everything else, that solving those problems, I mean, mindfulness plays a role in that.
Yeah, I think ultimately if you're going to solve some of the biggest climate crises and environmental crises globally, it starts by each individual on Earth having an appreciation and respect for the natural world. So if every human woke up and the first thing they did was think about the fact that the Earth exists and everything it provides for us and have an appreciation of that, then the actions we took subsequently the rest of the day would be stewarding that Earth instead of absentmindedly destroying it because we don't have an appreciation for it because we haven't spent the time to learn how to appreciate it. Which I think is what happens is if you have the chance to go on a retreat, you have a chance to slow down and to notice everything that's going on.
These mindfulness programs for teenagers have been going on for about 6 or 7 years so far. Do you have people coming back who are now in their 20s and participating in the programs as instructors or in some other ways?
Yeah, actually, one of the people that would be on our New Mexico retreat, a young woman named Leota, came on our first retreat in Virginia when she was 14. And she's been on about 16 Inward Bound retreats now. And she went every summer. We had weekend retreats and then New Year's retreats. And more than anything, I think they helped shape her in her adolescence. And so she's been a big part of it. And she moved out to Albuquerque last year. And so she's going to help manage this year's retreat. And so one of the things we try and do is as the youth graduate into a new era, of helping them and having them be part of the program. So a lot of the managers and the staff on our retreat are actually graduates that have grown up through the program.
We will give information at the end of this program about how people can get in touch and find out about attending those retreats if there's some young people listening who'd like to do that. Now, John Brayman, you've also spent your whole life as an educator working with young people. What's your participation in this work?
Well, first of all, I'm just thrilled that Patrick is here helping us bring together the first mindfulness meditation retreat of this type for teens in New Mexico, and he couldn't have chosen a better place. My own history with the Vallecitos goes back to 1998 when I was awarded one of the fellowships for social activists from around the world to come to New Mexico. At that time, I was living in Boston, and I was joined together with about 15 others for a 10-day mindfulness retreat in Vallecitos that really helped me in my work with social activism back in Boston. So I know the power of the place and the power of these tools. I see, personally, mindfulness meditation as an essential survival tool for all beings in the 21st century. I think we live in an age of interruption, which many of us adults know about, but we're quite unaware of how it's impacting youth. Multitasking does not improve performance. The science shows that. And I see meditation as a countervailing force against the age of interruption.
The age of interruption. Multitasking, it's funny that you say multitasking doesn't work. I mean, one of the things that science has also shown is that women are the ultimate multitaskers and that we're actually good at it.
Uh-huh. Well, you'll have to tell us about that, Charlotte.
But
we've studied college students in elite IB settings, and you know it's quite obvious that their performance decreases, even though they think it's increasing.
When they're looking at devices, talking to people, reading books all at the same time.
Talk to any professor, in lectures, and they wonder what's happening when students are looking at smartphones and laptops and doing a variety of things from text messaging to searching the internet and taking notes or whatever it is that they're doing. I think this extreme busyness is perceived to be accomplishment. And in terms of skillfulness or performance, things fall off a little bit.
Now, you've participated in global education programs where you bring young people from different cultures together who speak different languages and get them to communicate in ways that are very low-tech.
Exactly. And I'm so glad to hear Patrick identifying the importance of nature in these contemplative experiences. I had students from China coming to New Mexico through a United World College program called Global Leadership Forum not too far back. And the Chinese students wanted to do more than anything. They just wanted to walk in the forest. And we set a challenge for the students to help design the program in a constructivist way in the moment of the program happening. And the students elected to wake up early so that they could go into the forest and watch the sunrise in the morning. And that it didn't detract from the program, they just put extra effort into it. But even without a focused mindfulness training in that morning session, the students adopted an activity that got them to a mindfulness state about nature. We also offered very low-key and informal meditation experiences as an option for the international students, and about a third of the students elected to participate in those offerings. So I think there's a universal capacity for dropping down into a more focused and restful state. I do think that there's also the universal challenges of especially technology worldwide in providing enough opportunity for students to experience the state of being, and a kind of forceful intervention of the sort that Patrick is proposing with this mindfulness meditation retreat in northern New Mexico, highly skilled practitioners who are going to be giving directions about how to get into a restful, calm state is just what the world needs now.
Very interesting and very important. And I mean, talking not only about environmental problems, but real problems of war and peace. I mean, this is the ultimate practice of peace.
Absolutely. Well, if peace begins with, you know, an element of listening to the other side, it's very difficult to listen with any potential for an open mind if one is agitated, if one is nervous, angry, emotionally upset. And mindfulness can be a tool for kind of modulating one's emotional state for the sake of deep listening to the other.
We're talking to John Brayman and Patrick Cook Deegan about mindfulness education. Now, Patrick, you are a world traveler and real outdoorsman. Tell us about some of the traveling that you've done, which has kind of coincided with the mindfulness practices that you've done.
Well, the first big trip I did was after my sophomore year at Brown University. I took a year off, and I traveled around the world alone. And I went to maybe a dozen countries, Southeast Asia. I lived in Turkey for a little bit, New Zealand and Thailand. And then the following summer, that was like my first big trip. Then the next summer, I wanted to give something back to some of the places I'd been. So I decided to ride my bicycle about 3,000 miles through Southeast Asia, through Laos, Cambodia, and Burma. The purpose was to raise money to build a school in Laos and provide girls scholarships in Cambodia. And when I was on the trip, I was mostly alone. I wasn't speaking English for a long time, sometimes a week or two at a time. And I spent a lot of time in my own head. And, you know, seeing the devastation in the aftermath of the Vietnam War, which is still, there's a lot of places in Laos you can't go because there's unexploded ordnances. Cambodia is devastated, and the United States originally gave weapons to Pol Pot. So there's all of this guilt and anger that I was feeling about my relationship with the terrors that had happened there. And so one of my friends in Phnom Penh in Cambodia, I was talking to them about this, and they're like, you need to go on a meditation retreat. Like, you're totally in your head. You're so full of anger. So I biked to the middle of nowhere in northwest Cambodia and went to a 10-day meditation retreat.
The Vipassana meditation.
Yeah, Vipassana meditation retreat. No, more than anything, changed my life. And I had been experiencing so much anger about so many different things for 21 years. And on the eighth day of the retreat, it was almost like someone put an industrial vacuum cleaner to my brain and just sucked out the anger. And I went from so agitated to so calm. And I tried so many different things to calm myself down, going into the woods, going alone, working out. But nothing had done it like that before. And so after that, I continued to do a 10-day meditation retreat each year now for 6 or 7 years. And I continue to go into the backcountry and continue to travel around the world, because I think that they're all interrelated, right? The connection between global peace and inner peace, and the connection between what's happening in Los Alamos or Santa Fe or Albuquerque now and what's going on in northern Laos, they're all very interconnected. And the more that you spend time abroad and the more time you spend inward, the more that you see that interconnection.
Yeah. And then how do you take that connection to action, activism, activity in the outer world?
So before working for Inward Bound, I worked on human rights in Burma for 5 years. So I was an international human rights advocate and worked for an organization called U.S. Campaign for Burma. And during my bike trip in 2006, I traveled around Burma, which is in many ways the heartland of meditation, or one of them, and was appalled at the dictatorship there, and then came back and spoke at a lot of places around the United States about the dictatorship in Burma and the human rights abuses there. And I think through the process of meditation, realized that ultimately I'm only going to be happy if I'm using the skills and tools I have to make other people happy and more free. And I think that freedom comes in many different forms. It's, there's an inner freedom and an outer freedom, and that they're very linked. And so once you gain more inner freedom and inner peace, I think the natural instinct is for you to share that with others in whatever form it happens, big or small, simple or complex.
It is, I have to say, kind of humbling and worthy of contemplation that some of these places, for example, Burma, which has this incredible seed of enlightenment, this practice of meditation that you've done and that I've done and that many people have done, can still, after all these centuries and millennia, be a horrible, brutal military dictatorship.
Yeah, well, most of the military leaders there aren't going on meditation retreats.
No, I know, but the people somehow let it happen.
Yeah. I think let it happen is maybe a tough term. I think that it's happened in almost every country across the globe, right? There's no country that exists now that hasn't had state violence or some form of violence exist within its own country during its history. And so I think just picking out one part of the globe and saying this is happening there, like, I mean, look at World War One, look at anything else,
right?
That people in all places have the great capacity for good and evil, despite whatever religious background or contemplative practice takes place there. But if everyone dove into the deeper and more wisdom practices within their culture, there, I think there would be a lot less violence in Southeast Asia, in Africa, in wherever across the globe.
Right.
So I don't think it's specific to a geographical region. I think it's the human conundrum in many ways.
Right. And also the human conundrum of power, which is when you have a perfectly nice, decent, and generally peaceful populace, a small group of people can essentially terrorize them.
Yeah, and power is the ultimate thing that many men and women, but especially men, are aspiring to. And part of what mindfulness practice has done for me is realize what an illusion that is. Like, what do you gain by power? You know, and usually what you gain through power is living in more and more fear. And because the capacity and the drive to keep power then encourages behavior that's not kind, that's not compassionate, that's not for the benefit of others. And so it's the myth of power. And a lot of that is propelled by the lack of people that are seeking power to look within and see what is really motivating me to take this action. And if more people were doing that, especially people in power, I think you would have a lot more compassionate local and global society.
We're talking about Inward Bound Mindfulness Meditation, which is the name of the organization that Patrick Cook Deegan is involved with. Now, as we said, there are mindfulness meditation retreats for teenagers ages 15 to 19, I think.
Yeah,
right?
15 to 19. And if there's someone a little bit younger, a little bit older, we're flexible.
Okay. And so it's June 16th through 21st of this year here in New Mexico. And if people want to find out more, they can go to ibme.info. IBME stands for Inward Bound Mindfulness Education. John Brayman, talk a little more about what you're up to.
Well, one of the things I'm up to is trying to bring contemplative approaches into the world of education. And I just am glad that I can comment about that for a minute, because one of the inhibitors of the dispersal of mindfulness practice in our schools across the land is the perception that mindfulness is prayer. And as you're well aware, we have a pretty distinct separation of church and state in our culture. At the same time, schools and teachers exercise a great deal of self-censorship about this almost taboo area of church and state. And to avoid conflict, many teachers will just avoid the topic of teaching factual information about religion or practices like mindfulness that could bring to students the experience of a kind of a generic way to actually improve concentration and limit some of the troublesome thoughts that come into students' minds around fear of failure and so forth and so on. So I've been active for 25, 30 years in insinuating mindfulness practice into schools in ways that are safe and non-controversial.
And what does that look like?
It looks like what I would call the secularization of a contemplative practice like meditation, equaling the practice of mindfulness.
But I mean, like,
okay,
kids, sit in your chairs and close your eyes. Like,
well, yeah, actually, at Albuquerque Academy for 10 years when I was teaching environmental education at the academy, students from grades 6 through 12 would practice mindfulness in the outdoors during their outdoor education time, 20 minutes in the morning, 20 minutes in the afternoon, and it was a very secular approach involving directions about watching breath. There was no mantra. There was no religiosity involved whatsoever. And we had different names for it according to the grade level. One was called the Grok Rock, where students could pick out rocks and sit on them and grok their environment with their eyes closed or their eyes open. So these were, you know, modulated ways of increasing concentration and the appreciation of the moment without even verging into the use of the term meditation.
I have to say, I think some of those practices, if you just leave kids alone without devices and so on, come naturally. I mean, I remember as a kid just sitting there looking at the individual strands in the blade of grass. Nobody was telling me to do Zen or looking at exactly how the petals of a flower kind of grew out of one another, and which turns out to be fractal patterns and all that stuff. But if you just leave kids alone, they're going to do it by themselves.
But we all know that the challenges of young people finding time to simply play by themselves. The environment is not considered to be safe in the urban environment.
Yeah.
There's less access to the outdoors for purposes of simply fooling around and playing. So one of the things I'm delighted about with Patrick's movement, or his help with this movement, is that we're structuring opportunities for the liberation from the distractions, the interruptions, the pressures, and actually creating some playtime for the mind.
So these retreats for teenagers are, you don't have to be of any religion. You can be an atheist, Catholic, Jew, whatever? Or how's that work?
Yeah, we have students from all different backgrounds. And the retreats are secular, meaning that they're non-religious. It's not Buddhism by the back door at all. And in fact, one of the retreats we're doing this summer is in partnership with the UCLA Mindful Awareness Research Center in Southern California. And we have researchers this summer coming from the University of Pennsylvania. So it's mindfulness meditation has been studied through Harvard, through a bunch of different top-notch universities in the United States, showing the scientific benefits of it. And so mindfulness meditation is a secular practice, and that's what we're teaching on our retreats. And so we have people of all backgrounds, and anyone can benefit from the practice.
Very much so. And for these teen retreats, there is a cost, but there's also scholarships available.
Yeah, and in our history at Inward Bound, we've never turned away a teen. So if anyone in the state or anyone listening to this, if they have a friend or a son or a daughter or a nephew or anyone wants to come on the retreat, like, we'll make it work. And we want people that want to be there. So if you want to come, you'll be able to come.
Inward Bound Mindfulness Education. Patrick Cook Deegan is the West Coast director of that organization. Again, IBME.info. John Brayman is an educator and head of Brayman Group International. Thank you both so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.